This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Good morning to all the good people. Tell everybody to tune in to Voices with Vision, your show that is not for the politically faint of heart. We bring you voices from the front lines of the struggle, radical analysis from radical perspectives that are generally censored from the corporate media. I'm Netford Freeman, your co-host, and we are back after the centennial celebration of Miles Davis last week and African Liberation Day celebrations, rallies, and symposium over the last two weekends. There's always so much going on in the struggle and on Jazz and Justice Radio. But tell us what's good, Brother Craig.
Good morning, Netha, and good morning to all of our radio and online listeners. Hey, I firmly believe, in fact, I know, that we will win as long as we are politically educated, organized, and keep fighting for liberation, like we say at the end of every program. In today's show, we talk about Cuba, that revolution and that culture that has never fallen back since the onset of their revolution in 1959. Specifically, we speak with retired Professor Stephen Kimber, an award-winning writer, editor, and broadcaster, about his recent article in Resumen, True Lies Across the Water, about the hypocrisy behind the U.S. charges of murder against former Cuban President Raul Castro with respect to the downing of Brothers to the Rescue planes in 1996.
It's been a while since Stephen Kimber was last on the show, and it's good to have him back. And in the spirit of bringing your attention back to Voices with Vision that we've had on the show before, the Nyamburu ambassadors have released new information about the struggle that they're leading on the University of Maryland campus, College Park. We can report that a protest demonstration is planned for Friday, June 5th at 1 p.m., that all interested parties and supporters are invited to attend. The protest will take place at the main entrance of the campus at the corner of Baltimore Avenue and Regent's Drive. Students, faculty, and alum are gathering to demand repairs to the Nyamburu Cultural Center, an extension of the interim director's contract, and accountability and transparency from university leadership. More information can be found on their Instagram at nyum.ambassadors. That's NYUM.ambassadors.
Now, to kick off our show this morning, we have a commentary from political prisoner and freedom fighter Mumia Abu-Jamal discussing what he calls the Great Grift. For all the freedom fighters held behind U.S. and Israeli walls, what's the call?
Free them all.
In an era of the Great Grift. One writer called it Griftopia. This is an era of taking, where people are snatching stuff just because they want it, straight out of the air. And it's no longer covered by, you know, political niceties, a soft, sonorous voice, international law. They take things because they want things, and they take things using the military because of the strength and the quote-unquote lethality of the military. This is the great grift, the great take. And why is it happening now? You know why? I think they know that this thing is on the brink of failure. And if they don't take it now, they won't be able to take it tomorrow. But they want to take it before the ecological situation becomes really unlivable, untenable. Water systems break down, electric systems collide because they're building so many data centers to support AI industries that small towns and villages will get crushed below the weight of their bills and electricity bills and water bills to support these systems. Everybody is getting in on the grift, the take, the getting paid, because this is that moment. Capital is rapacious and awake to the great grift that's happening every day right in front of our eyes. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Okay, now for Freeman in the virtual studio with Brother Craig. A lot has been said about Cuba and the U.S. warmongering drumbeats to war against Cuba. In the province of Camagüey, thousands of Cubans gathered last Sunday in Plaza de la Libertad to express their rejection of the recent accusations by the U.S. government against Army General Raul Castro Ruz. The U.S. federal indictment against the former President Raul Castro Ruz charges him with four counts of murder, conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals, and the destruction of an aircraft stemming from a 1996 incident when Cuban MiG fighter jets shot down two aircrafts belonging to the Miami-based Brothers to the Rescue. The statements made on May 20th by the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, along with the decision by the so-called Department of Justice to file charges against the former Cuban president, are just two of the news stories that in recent days have contributed to a warmonger's case against Cuba, which would eventually be used as a pretext to launch a military action against the island. In this interview, Voices with Vision will debunk misinformation and lies by unpacking the real story behind the so-called murder charge against former Cuban President Raul Castro. We're honored to have with us Stephen Kimber, a retired professor of journalism at the University of King's College in Halifax and co-founder of the university's Master of Fine Arts and Creative Nonfiction program. Stephen is an award-winning writer, editor, and broadcaster, and he is the author of the recent article in Resumen Latinoamericano, True Lies Across the Water, True Lies Across the Water, addressing this case against Raul Castro. He's also the author of the groundbreaking book, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five, and Stephen and I were also organizers in the organization, the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. Stephen, welcome back to Voices with Vision.
Thank you, Ned. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. Welcome to Voices with Vision. And Stephen, I wanted to just start off, you know, Ned mentioned in his introduction that this case involved the Cubans shooting down some Brothers to the Rescue aircraft. Can you tell us, who are the Brothers to the Rescue, or who were the Brothers to the Rescue organization?
Sure. The Brothers to the Rescue was started by a guy by the name of Jose Basulto, who was a Miami-based acknowledged terrorist against Cuba in the 1960s and 70s. He fired cannons at hotels and various other things. He claimed to have had his come to Jesus moment at some point in the 1980s. And by the early 1990s, he had formed this organization. He was a pilot, and he formed this organization with other exile pilots. And the reason for it was because at around that time, there were a fair number of Cuban economic refugees trying to get to Florida, because if they could get to Florida, they were promised special dispensation on the road to citizenship that was available to no other country in the world. So people did come, and they came in rickety rafts and various sundry other things. And so what happened was Brothers to the Rescue would fly out over the Straits of Florida. They would come across rafters out there. They would notify the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard would come to them and pick them up and bring them to the United States. And so, you know, they were heroes. And also, this was a very good fundraising effort for Brothers to the Rescue. They raised several million dollars in the early 1990s for the work that they did. And they were recognized as heroes in the exile community in Miami. But then in 1994, the Cubans and the Clinton administration came to an agreement, basically, that said, they were going to try to regularize immigration. So the Cubans, or the Americans, would agree to admit at least 20,000 Cubans a year who wanted to come, but they would have to come by the normal means. And if they didn't, if they tried to come by raft or whatever, and they were caught, they would be sent either to Guantanamo or another base and then back to Cuba, basically. So, you know, the people who were in those rafts trying to get to Florida suddenly looked up at the sky and saw these Brothers to the Rescue airplanes overhead, and they waved them off. They said, you know, leave us alone. We don't want to be caught in this. So suddenly they had nobody to rescue. So they needed a purpose, a goal, and something that would help them to raise funds again. So what they came up with was provocation, basically. They began, Basulto and others, flying into Cuban airspace beginning in late 1994. So only a couple of months after the agreement between Clinton and the Cubans. And they, you know, started to harass the Cubans in many different ways. They flew over Havana numerous times, dropping medallions and other things onto the ground, trying to stir up rebellion in Cuba. It didn't do any good, but at the same time, it was very disruptive and all sorts of things. So, and the Cubans from the beginning protested this. This is illegal. You are not allowed to fly into another country's airspace without permission. That's just international aviation law says you can't do that.
And for good reason, because it would be dangerous to just let something like that happen.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, think about this. If a Cuban airplane suddenly decided to fly over the Capitol in Washington, how long do you think they'd be up there before they were shot out of the sky? So the Cubans, on the other hand, actually tried to resolve this diplomatically. They protested to the Americans on numerous occasions. And this is all documented. It's, you know, the protest that they made. They didn't have diplomatic relations between the Cubans and the Americans at that time. So it was all went through the Swiss embassy. And there's these great long, the flowery language things in which each side talks about the other side and gracious and grateful to receive your message of such and such. But the message itself was saying, look, they're flying over our airspace. We don't want them there. Stop them. And this went on for 15 months, if you can imagine. 15 months back and forth. The Cubans reached a point where they threatened to blow these planes out of the sky. And they didn't do it in quick time. This is over 15 months. And you had a situation where the Cubans were protesting, as I said, diplomatically, but they were also trying to get the message to the Americans in other ways. So, for example, Richardson, who was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations at the time, came to visit Cuba, had a conversation with Fidel, and they were talking about all sorts of things, But it was very important that the Cubans brought up the question of Brothers to the Rescue and how are you going to go about stopping the Brothers to the Rescue. In January or February of 1996, just a month before the actual shoot down, you get a situation where there's a delegation of retired U.S. military people who come to Cuba and meet with Cuban officials. And it's, I mean, even though we think of this sort of tense relationship that they had, but in fact, these kinds of things happened all the time. And so the Cubans said to Eugene Carroll, who was a retired admiral and the leader of this delegation, look, if you don't stop these, if you, being the Americans, don't stop them, we will. What would the Americans think if we blew these planes out of the sky? Carroll went back to the United States, met with the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice, and said, here's what the Cubans are saying. And they're legally entitled to say this, right? This is legitimate stuff. And it was not as if the American government in entirety ignored all of this. In fact, if you go back, when the Brothers to the Rescue first started going into Cuban airspace, the Federal Aviation Administration took notice. They announced that they were going to take action and suspend the license of Jose Basulto for, you know, these clear violations of international airspace. So that was what was, you know, it was that is the backdrop in many ways for what happened later.
Thank you. I wanted to just circle back because sure. You mentioned in the beginning your description of the Brothers to the Rescue, that it was founded by Jose Basulto, that he was basically a known terrorist. I think he also explained at some point that he worked with the CIA. And it just reminded me of a song by Maccabee, the reggae artist out of Birmingham, England, who had a song, you know, Who Are the Terrorists? Who Are the Heroes? Jose Basulto being maybe, and the Brothers to the Rescue being heroes to some of the people perhaps that wanted to be rescued out of the waters, but certainly not heroes to the freedom and justice loving people of Cuba who believe in their sovereignty, their right to exist and to have the type of government society that they want, which is one that puts people over profits and has principled relations with, you know, freedom movements all around the world.
No, absolutely. I mean, he was, you know, he is an acknowledged terrorist and a proud terrorist. He was at the time. And, you know, when he says that he, you know, found that it wasn't God, but it was, you know, he started reading Gandhi and other things, was what he said in the late 1980s. But the fact is, it's one of the things that came out in the trial of the Cuban Five. It wasn't exactly clear where it came from, but it is almost certain that it was information that was gained by agents, either of the Cuban Five or other Cuban agents who had infiltrated Brothers to the Rescue. And that was this, that during the time that all this was happening, Brothers to the Rescue were test firing weapons that could be used against the Cuban people. So it wasn't just medallions and pamphlets and leaflets. The Cubans knew, and this would make it that much more urgent to get this resolved, that they were in fact dealing with real weapons. And at the same time, Basulto was in correspondence with arms dealers who were trying to sell him used Czech military aircraft. So, you know, it wasn't as much as it was seen as benign. It wasn't. And as much as he was seen as not a terrorist at this point, certainly the Cubans saw him that way in what he was doing with Brothers to the Rescue.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is both what Craig just asked and what you mentioned just now gets us into, I think, a little bit of more historical context that people should understand. And that is the case of the Cuban Five, or even, I guess, it's the case of the Cuban Five, but all of that context around it, or the mission of the Cuban Five, it kind of shows a vivid context that gives legitimacy to the real national security concerns of the Cuban government. So if you can go into that, like, there's more, there's, you know, actual terrorism that has taken place. And that, you know, I also noted that in your, and maybe you can tie this in, this with your answer, in your article, like, you don't really mention Raul Castro very much. And also how much that, you know, and but he was the defense minister, but also people have to understand, I don't know how much he may or may not have had to do with the orders, because that really is not really relevant. But if you can go into, I don't think it is, even if he had, you know, but if you can go into that context, the history of terrorism, the mission of the Cuban Five that actually resulted in this mission of the Cuban Five.
Sure. I mean, you can go back. Is it, how many years do you go back to sort of say what the context for this was? Back to the revolution and immediately after the revolution and the Bay of Pigs and the blowing up of the airliner, the attack on the ship in Havana Harbor. And by the 1990s, this is sort of at the time that the Soviet Union collapsed, and you know, all the Miami exile leadership was saying basically next year in Havana, we're going to be there, we're going to take it over, we're going to win. And they became, I guess you would say, impatient with any other way to get there. And so they started hiring mercenaries and sending their own people over there to do things like blow up hotels. The idea was that if you could scare off tourists, you could undermine the Cuban economy and speed up its downfall. And so there was a bunch of hotels that were targeted by bombers. And there was an Italian-Canadian businessman, a young businessman, who was killed in one of those raids, right? So that there was all of that sort of happening. And the Cuban Five were sent there not to do anything in terms of stopping these things physically, right? I mean, they weren't there to attack anyone else. They were there to find out what was going on and to report it back to Cuba so that Cuba could take defensive actions to protect itself. And in fact, it did. I mean, there were lots of cases that I documented in the book where, you know, bombers were on their way to Cuba with bombs in their suitcases, and they'd be caught because the Cubans knew they were coming, right? So there was a lot of that sort of stuff that was going on. And so that was the backdrop at that time. And in the lead up to 1996, when the planes got shot out of the air, it's all part of that very clear provocation against the Cuban government, against the Cuban people, that was going on and that they were responding to. And so the response in terms of the Brothers to the Rescue was understandable, legitimate, legal, and to a certain extent necessary, right? I mean, what are you going to do if you're continuing to allow these invaders to come into your airspace and potentially start firing missiles at your cities?
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask you one follow-up question. It's as a journalist and as a professor of journalism, you know, we know about this, the work we've done around the terrorism leveled against Cuba. But the fact that most people, particularly in the United States, have no idea that this is part of this history. They don't, and even right now, as they're talking about this case or so-called talking about it, you know, there's no alluding to or going, you know, filling in this context. What does that say about real news or journalism, at least that the U.S. population is exposed to or seems to depend on?
I think, you know, one of the problems with journalism is that it, in a sense, the journalists and the journalism operates in a context where there's certain acceptable things, accepted things, the way the world works. And so they don't ask the questions. And, you know, I was shocked when I was doing that book. You know, any journalist who read, or anyone who read the transcript of the Cuban Five trial, it was 20,000 words, so it was, or 20,000 pages, so it was a lot to read. But at the same time, it became very clear that this was a travesty of justice. And anybody who spent the time to look at it would see that. Unfortunately, that's not the way mainstream media, not just in the United States, but in any country, really seems to work. So it's important that there be alternative voices. And it's important that those alternative voices do whatever they can to be heard. Because, you know, right now, I mean, if you just to take this one example of putting Raul Castro on trial for a murder, hey, turn around, look at the president of the United States, who has, you know, been very quick to order the attacks on fishing boats that he claims are drug boats in the Caribbean and killing people. 200 people have been killed as a result of those attacks. And there's been no clear justification for any of it, right? So if somebody should be up for murder, perhaps it should be the president of the United States and not the former president of Cuba. I mean, Castro, Raul Castro, if I remember correctly, accepted responsibility for the decision to shoot down those planes because of all the things that we talked about, all the justifications that we talked about. But that was in his role as the president, as the defense minister in Cuba, and he made a decision. He had all sorts of justifications for that decision. I don't think you can say the same about Trump.
Mm-mm, not at all. Now, I want to say this real quick, Craig, before you, just so people know, because we're alluding to and mentioning the case of the Cuban Five, which people should know about, I think, in the context of all of this. And the Cuban Five were arrested and held in the U.S. jails for a long time until 2014, when they were all released, you know, in that rapprochement, should we say, between U.S. Obama administration and the Cuban government. So they're out now. But, you know, it was a case where anti-terrorists were, there was some pretext or something, you know, created to imprison them. There were Cubans that came here, like Stephen said. But I just wanted to put that out there, and just anyone might have not known what happened. And then you, like we said, your book talks about this in great detail. What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five, tells all about the case of the Cuban Five and everything else around it.
Yeah.
Well, let's hold it right there to find out what's happening in the social justice calendar. We'll be right back.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of June 1st, 2026. On Wednesday, June 3rd from 6 to 8 p.m., join Arlington for Palestine and NAACP Arlington Branch for a movie night and community discussion about Israeli apartheid. Located at the Fairlington Community Center, that's 3308 South Stafford Street, Arlington, Virginia. They will watch two short Palestinian films about life under Israeli apartheid, hear from a member of Arlington for Palestine about their trip to Palestine last year, and discuss together what all this means for people living in Arlington. Doors open at 5:45 p.m. and the event will start at 6 p.m. A light dinner will be served. More info and registration is at eventbrite.com. On Friday, June 5th from 6 to 7:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe hosts author Aria Jackson for a conversation from here to there, an indescribable point in life with Kuron Harris. Located at Sankofa Books and Cafe, that's 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. Further info is at sankofa.com. On Saturday, June 6th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., join Free DC's Ward 17 to create the Free DC Parade banner and share your vision for a Free DC. Located at Sargent Memorial Presbyterian Church, that's 5109 Nanny Helen Burroughs Avenue, Northeast in Washington, D.C. Registration is available at freedcproject.org under the Events tab. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Social justice submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
You're listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart on your Jazz and Justice station. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
unpacking the real story behind the so-called murder charge against former Cuban President Raul Castro. We're honored to have with us Stephen Kimber, the author of the recent article in Resumen Latinoamericano, True Lies Across the Water, addressing this case against Raul Castro.
And I think it's really important that people kind of get up to speed with the context of all of this. You know, Stephen, you mentioned already Trump's current, ongoing extrajudicial murders of fishermen at sea. But then there's also this escalation of terrorist sanctions against the people of Cuba that is also causing death, widespread death and suffering. And then outside of Cuba, you've got, the kidnapping of the president and first lady of Venezuela. You have the political, military, economic support for genocide against the Palestinians. You got unprovoked attacks on Iran. And so there seems to be so many reasons to hold the United States government and the Trump administration and Trump himself, to some type of legal account. But that brings me to my question. I mean, since President Raul Castro is, former President Raul Castro is 94 years old, the shooting down of these planes took place decades ago. Obviously, Cuba was provoked by the brothers to the rescue. They engaged in illegal acts, illegal in terms of Cuban law, illegal in terms of international law, illegal in terms of United States law. So what do you think is really going on with these charges? Do you think that maybe this is a part of a propaganda campaign in advance of an invasion or to justify some other type of attacks on Cuba?
I think it's already being used in that way. I mean, if you look at what's been happening, and here in Canada, we've had diplomatic and respectful relationships with Cuba going back to the time of the revolution. But right now, what you've got is a situation where Sherritt, which is a Canadian mining company, which has had a joint partnership with Cuba since 1990, has been forced to shut down because of the latest sanctions that the Trump administration has imposed. And what was really what's really interesting about that is that 2 days after Sherritt was forced to shut down its mining and operation in Cuba, an American friend of Donald Trump bought the company for not that much money. And it was approved by the State Department, which is the same State Department that is forbidding a Canadian company from operating in Cuba. So if you see, what you see right now, and what's also going on is part of these sanctions, I don't know where you are in terms of time, but part of the sanctions that is being imposed on Cuba right now, most of the hotels are going to shut down. They don't have a choice but to shut down. And that just undermines the economy further. It is an awful situation and a preparation for either an invasion, but what I think that Trump would hope for is something that will crumble the Cuban government because people can't be fed, people can't find work. All of these things are designed to undermine Cuba's resolve. I don't know that it will undermine their resolve, but on the other hand, if you're starving, what can you be resolved? So I think that it's really important that the rest of us stand up and speak out for Cuba at the very least.
Right. I mean, in what you said, I think people really should understand the role that Cuba has played internationally. It has been a friend to the world. I think that Cuba is the most internationalist country in the world, despite what it has, sharing what it can, providing what it can. It's really internalized what it means to be international, selflessly giving to other countries in the form of doctors, in the form of, vaccines and all that kind of stuff. People who are specialized in literacy, standing up for countries in the United Nations and taking principled stands. I mean, the list could go on at,
political asylum,
combatants during the, in particularly in Africa during the independence movements, giving people, you know, actually selflessly sending people to help with these struggles for independence against colonialism. I mean, so there's a lot there that we really owe Cuba an immense gratitude that cannot, I don't think it can be repaid into and for us if we don't really, take a, you know, unequivocal and really, you know, something, a formidable stand, you know, to prevent this, then I may be unfortunate.
And I think we who are in countries, you know, whether it's American or Canadian, we should be even more strong in what we're saying. Because if you think about, say, Jamaica right now, Jamaica has been forced by the Americans, the American administration, to turn back the Cuban doctors, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't say, oh, well, we'll replace them with American doctors. They said, screw that. You're just not allowed to have those Cuban doctors anymore. And that's happening in all sorts of Caribbean and other countries at this point, because they're trying to undermine Cuba, right?
Right. Thank you, Stephen. This has been a really good conversation. I'm glad we get you on. Unfortunately, the time, you know, is not on our side here. But I guess I should ask you one last, just allow you an open-ended question of something, anything that you think you wish we could have asked, you know, should have asked, you think people need to hear that we did not ask.
I don't have anything specific, except sort of as we were sort of leading up to there, I think it's really important that we all recognize what you were saying about the importance of Cuba in the world. It's clearly punching above its weight in so many different ways, from healthcare to education, to international assistance to other countries and to freedom fighters and all of that sort of stuff. And speak up, right? You know, this is not a good time.
No, it's not.
We've got to stand up. That's all we can do.
And hopefully, so one thing, and I'm going to give a maybe premature little plug here, that we're trying to organize the Institute for Policy Studies a screening of the film by the late IPS fellow Saul Landau entitled "Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up?" And invite you to come and be a speaker after that film. That might be a little premature because some details are not pinned down yet, but I wanted to just say that while we had you on. And the listeners, if we get that pinned down, you'll hear more about it. Thank you. We've been speaking with Stephen Kimber, who is a retired professor of journalism in Canada. I'm just going to give the abbreviated version. And then also the author of the latest article in Resumen Latino Americano, True Lies Across the Water, and also author of the book What Lies Across the Water, the Real Story of the Cuban Five. Thank you so much, Stephen, for being on Voice with Vision.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Fifteen years.
Luchando.
For 15 years, we were there fighting apartheid. Fighting racism till the very end. What were they doing with us? They said that we had to be imposed a blockade. And they were doing that, they said, because we were giving assistance to that country. Because we were fighting the South African racist. South Africa was not prevented from purchasing food and medicines. And the country that was heroically fighting against the racists was not sold one medicine, one aspirin, one cytostat for a cancer patient. That was the punishment. A moment when the war was practically lost. And then we, the Cubans, we had to solve the problem. We sent many of our best divisions, pilots, planes, and we said to them, we are going to prevent the South Africans from acting. When we arrived there, there was a great crisis. It was when the Cuito-Juana Valley battle took place.
¿Sabe cuántos hombres envió Cuba a Angola en ese momento?
You know how many troops Cuba sent to Angola at that moment?
55,000
troops.
55,000 hombres. Lo cual habría y voluntarios todos.
And all of them on voluntary basis.
Lo más importante.
That's the voluntario. Most important thing of all.
En Cuito Carnaval es este.
Implementation of Resolution 34435 and at the end to put an end to apartheid. That was our contribution to the heroic struggle of the South African people. At the United Nations, they don't speak about that. We have heard a great number of speeches. People spoke about the independence. They applauded the independence of the African countries. It would seem that that was the work and miracle of the United Nations.
Que hablaba del fin de la apartheid.
There were talks about the end of apartheid.
Obra y milagro.
Like the work and miracle of the United Nations.
De las Naciones Unidas. No se mencionó un solo cubano de los que murieron.
There was no mention about one Cuban of the many Cubans who died there.
El nombre de Cuba.
The name of Cuba was not even mentioned.
Vean cómo a veces.
So look how sometimes.
Se pretende. Escribir la historia.
People intend to write history, mira, forgetting reality.
El
one of the most
más arriesgada,
dangerous and risky pages written by the Cubans was the one written in that struggle against the racism and apartheid in South Africa.
Fueron los Namibios.
And the Namibians.
Fueron los Angolanos.
And the Angolans.
Y fuera de esos dos países.
Fought.
Solo Cuba.
And outside from those two countries, only Cuba was involved.
Derramó su sangre.
Only Cuba shed its generous blood against apartheid and against racism.
African Liberation Day events took place the weekend of May 23rd. And in furtherance of its Pan-Africanist purpose, we present you with an excerpt of Kwame Ture speaking at African Liberation Day organized by the All African People's Revolutionary Party in Washington, D.C. in 1983.
For African Liberation, Brother Kwame Ture.
Africans, we come to greet you on behalf of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. As you can see, this year our party didn't have much money. This year our party didn't have much time to organize African Liberation Day. But our party is trying to make it an institution. Consequently, our party says that we must begin to make Africans go to African Liberation Day like Christians go to church. Yes. A Christian goes to church every Sunday. A conscious Christian goes to church every Sunday. And going to church is not a big thing for a Christian. Consequently, going to African Liberation Day should not be a big thing for Africans. On the contrary, Africans know, just like Christians know they should go to church, Africans must know they must go to African Liberation Day. Our party has every intention of making African Liberation Day an institution. It's an institution necessary to make our people become responsible. President Sekou Touré, leader of the African Revolution, says, "The gravest crime any individual can commit is the crime of irresponsibility." Everywhere we've been made an irresponsible people by the enemy. The capitalist system makes us lazy. The capitalist system feeds us commercials and makes us live on commercials. The capitalist system gives us drugs. Everywhere it makes us irresponsible to our people. We must become responsible to our people. And the only way we can become responsible to our people is to understand our people's struggle, understand the forces that are opposed to our people's struggle, and come to fight with these struggles to make our people free. Our people are going to be free. Of this, there isn't the slightest question. In order to be free, one must control both the material and the immaterial aspect of life. A man cannot be free if he controls only the material aspect of his life. A woman cannot be free if she controls only the immaterial aspect of her life. In order to be free, we must control both the material and the immaterial aspect of our lives. For example, A man may have enough power, physical power, to force me to be a slave. That is to say, he may have guns, he may have whips, and he may have the institutions of his society, which bring chaos to my society, and force me to work as a slave, to pick cotton. But even though this man may force me to be a slave for 400 years, he will never force me to accept slavery in my mind as a way of life. We say in order for a people to be free, they must be in control of both the material and the immaterial aspect of life. Not only must we be in control of our resources in Africa, but we must be in control of our thinking. This is crucial. Some people get confused. Some people think if they have big cars, if they have big houses, if they control the material aspect of life, but they don't control the immaterial aspect of life, they are free. They're incorrect. Some think that if their mind is free, but their body is not free, they are free. They're incorrect. I've met many brothers. Brother told me, I was up in jail, brother, but I was free. I said, you were. He said, yeah. I said, were you behind bars? He said, yeah. I said, you were free. He said, yeah, they couldn't do nothing to my mind. That's right. Your mind might be free, but if you're in jail, your body is not free. And if your body is not free, you are not free. You're only free when your mind and your body is free. Our struggle then is to control not only the material aspect, but the immaterial aspect of life. We must be very clear here. We must be crucial clear here. We must know the difference between reform and revolution. The All African People's Revolutionary Party is not a reform party. We are a revolutionary party. Consequently, you cannot judge the All African People's Revolutionary Party by reform standards. If you do, you'll make a mistake. You cannot even judge a Christian by Muslim standards. If you judge a Christian by Muslim standards, that Christian would be a bad Muslim, because Muslims don't drink. Christians do. One of the first miracles that Jesus Christ worked, he transformed water to wine. Consequently, if you're a Christian, you go to communion, you drink wine. But if you're Muslim, you should not drink wine. You can only judge a Christian by Christian standards. You can only judge a Muslim by Muslim standards. You can only judge a reformist by reform standards. You can only judge a revolutionary by revolutionary standards. There's confusion everywhere. Some people are judging our party by reform methods. They expect us to do what reform movements are doing. Reform movements do not want to destroy American capitalism. They like America. They want a piece of America. The All African People's Revolutionary Party doesn't want a piece of the American capitalist system. We want the destruction of the American capitalist system. Watch then now and you will see how this difference reflects itself in our material organizing. You will go today and everywhere you will hear people screaming about Reagan. They're saying Reagan did this, Reagan did that, Reagan, Reagan, Reagan. We of the All African People's Revolutionary Party tell you honestly, this word Reaganism was invented by Wall Street to confuse the masses of the people. Our party's a revolutionary party. We don't come here to scream at Reagan. Why does it make sense to scream at Reagan? Even in evolutionary form of electoral politics, in 8 years, Reagan is going to disappear anyway. In 8 years, he will not be able to run. So all those who are screaming against Reaganism 8 years from now will have to find something new to scream about. The All African People's Revolutionary Party been screaming against capitalism and gonna keep screaming against capitalism until we destroy capitalism. Here then, the difference is clear. We don't come here to talk about Reaganism. We come here to talk about revolution. Our people must be free. But in order for our people to be free, we must come seriously to work for the freedom of our people. Herein lies the great problem. Many of us want to be free. Many of us want to see our people free. But we just dream about being free. We think about being free, but we don't do nothing about being free. Consequently, if you just think about it, but you don't do nothing about it, it's better you think about something else, because you ain't doing that which you're thinking about. As a matter of fact, the only way you can really think about something is when you are doing it. The only ones who can truly think about working for the people are those who are working for the people. Only a swimmer can think seriously about swimming. A non-swimmer cannot even know how to swim, cannot conceive of thinking of swimming. Consequently, it is only those who are working for the people that can really think about the people. The situation must be properly understood. The line that we're pushing must be properly understood. We are saying that words cannot criticize action. And words cannot move the people to activity. It is only activity that moves the people to activity. A lot of people criticize the All African People's Revolutionary Party. But we of the All African People's Revolutionary Party do not accept criticisms from anybody if they are not organizing the people. I've been organizing the people for over 22 years, consciously. Our party makes mistakes. President Sekou Touré, leader of the African Revolution, says the only party that will not make a mistake is a party that does absolutely nothing. Our party has made mistakes. Our party will make mistakes. Of this we know it. We're not worried here. We will stumble. The Chinese say to stumble is not to fall. It's only to go forward faster. Yes. But we want to make it clear. With the mistakes our party makes, our party cannot be criticized by anyone except those who are actively organizing our people. If you are not organizing our people and you think you're criticizing the party, you have no valid criticism of the party. Can someone who's a swimmer be listened to the criticism of someone who's never got into water? No. Only a swimmer can criticize a swimmer. Only someone who's doing something can make criticism. Consequently, those who are not organizing the people are totally incapable of making any criticism about our party at all. We wanted to be clear here. Some people say, all your party do is African Liberation Day. That's all they do. Every year they do this one thing. If that's all we do, they should be happy because that which we do is positive. And when someone's doing something positive, you don't criticize them. On the contrary, you encourage them. All those who attack our party are reactionary. And their line and basis is clear here. Anyone looking at how disorganized our people is, how can you come to seriously criticize someone who's trying to organize the people? No, here your criticism is reactionary. 97% of the masses of our people do not belong to any organization fighting for the people. Listen to it very carefully. Understand it properly. 97% of the masses of our people do not belong to any organization fighting for our people. And if you would look at America, we need to be more organized than any other ethnic group in America. This problem will only be solved when we ourselves come now to deal with it.
That concludes our show for this week. This show featured an edited clip of President Fidel Castro's 1995 speech at Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem and a portion of Kwame Ture's remarks at African Liberation Day in 1983. The full version of Kwame's speech and more can be found on the YouTube channel of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Southwest. Thank you for listening. Tune in to Voices with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
Stay tuned for Crossroads up next with Roach Brown, Martine Moore Brown, and Nkechi Taifa. Remember to make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. Or fall back.
It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. L-I-B-R-B-G, we live F-R-E-D-I-E. We lace music with code, just something to bring us closer. Kick true, the young black youth like we're supposed to. No swine in our rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cent and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement, y'all just rap. Brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot, Miss Everly's boy in the back. Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back. Sand code for writing exact. It's the red, green, and the black, black, black.
It go F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K.
Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back. Ain't trying to die for your freedom.
heartfelt thank you to all our WPFW donors, both new and returning, for your incredible support during our recent Spring Pledge Drive. Your generosity helps amplify the sounds of emancipatory music and movements. If you haven't had the chance to donate yet, now is the time. Please visit WPFWFM.org to help us close the $79,000 gap between our goal and what we've raised. It's listeners like you who keep a song in our heart and independent music and journalism thriving at WPFW, ensuring that jazz and justice reach everyone. Thank you for being part of our community.
WPFW continues to celebrate our 50th year with another benefit concert at the Palisades Hub, Sunday, June 14th, from 4 till 6 p.m. You can enjoy live jazz music by Washington area-based artists while helping to keep Jazz and Justice on the air. Sets by Amy K. Bormet on piano and voice, plus saxophonist Elijah Jamal Balbed with his quartet and special guest vocalist. Tickets on Eventbrite via the link on our homepage, WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one live performance at a time.
Black Women Thriving, East of the River, a 501c3 nonprofit, will be having a mayoral and at-large council candidate forum on Thursday, June 4th at 6:30 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center in Southeast D.C. The candidates will speak about healthcare, economic opportunity, and the future of Wards 7 and 8. Further information and how to RSVP is at blackwomenthriving.org or through the Black Women Thriving East of the River Instagram page.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 24th DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 5th to the 11th at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema, discussions with filmmakers, opening night reception celebrating 60 years of independence for Barbados and Guyana, and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 5th to the 11th. Information at afi.com/silver, afi.com/silver, or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW Local Station Board is holding a community town hall on Saturday, June 13th, from 12 noon to 3 p.m. at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. The agenda will focus on the well-being of the station, voting rights, community concerns, and the upcoming Pacifica Foundation elections. More information is online at WPFWFM.org or by emailing the local station board at WPFWLSB@WPFW.org.
WPFW, Washington, 89.3 FM.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What I do?
Turn around.